He knows more than he tells. But our skittish rauk balk at revealing more. Nor is this our soul such worry. Cowens refused to speak further regarding Lornix. Our Gekek cousins reel from the news that they are the last of their kind. And all of us are appalled to witness alien robots returning to base, laden with gassed, sleeping glavers, kidnapped from faraway herds for analysis under those once gay pavilions we lent our guests. Is this the return of innocence promised in the scrolls? Urja asks, doubt dripping like fumes from her lowered snout. How could a blessing arise out of base crime? If only we could ask the Glavers. Is this what they wanted when they chose the path of redemption?
Lark.
Well, look who it is. I'm surprised you have the nerve to show your face around here.
The Forayer woman's grin seemed at once both sly and teasing. She peeled off elastic gloves, turning from a glaver on a lab bench with wires in its scalp. There were several of the big trestle tables where human, Gekek, and Urish workers bent under cool, bright lamps, performing rote tasks they had been taught, helping their employers test animals sampled from sundry Jijoan ecosystems. Lark had dropped his backpack by the entrance. Now he picked it up again.
I'll go if you want.
No, no, please stay.
Ling waved him into the laboratory shelter, which had been moved to a shielded forest site the very night Lark last saw the beautiful intruder. The same evening, the Black Station buried itself under a fountain of piled dirt and broken vegetation. The basis for both actions was still obscure, but Lark's superiors now thought it must have to do with the violent destruction of one of the interloper's robots, an event his brother must have witnessed at close hand. Then there was the testimony of Reddy, the girl from over the mountains, supported by her treasure, a strange metal machine, once shaped like a Jijoan bird. Was it a Buyer remnant, as some supposed? If so, why should such a small item perturb the mighty Forayers? Unless it was like the tip of a red Kewan shell, innocuous at first sight, poking over a sand dune, part of much more than it seemed. The bird now lay in a cave, headless and mute, but Reddy swore it used to move. Lark had been ordered back down to the glade before his brother could confirm the story. He knew he shouldn't worry. Danil Ozawa was qualified to tend Dwar's wounds. Still, he deeply resented the recall order.
"Will you be needing me for another expedition?" he asked Ling.
"After you abandoned me the last time? We found human tracks when we finally got to where our robot went down. Is that where you rushed off to? Funny how you knew which way to go."
He shouldered his pack.
"Well, if you don't need me, then..." She swept a hand before her face.
"Oh, never mind. Let's move on. There's plenty of work if you want it."
Lark glanced dubiously at the lab tables. Of Jijo's six, all three of the races with good hand-eye coordination were employed. Outside, Hoons and Kewans also labored at the behest of aliens whose merest trinkets meant unimaginable wealth to primitive savages. Only Treiki were unseen among the speckled tents, since the ringed ones seemed to make the raiders nervous. Sepoy labor. That was the contemptuous expression Lena Strong had used when she brought Lark new orders at Tooth Slice Shavings Dam. an old earth term referring to aborigines toiling for mighty visitors paid in beads.
"Oh, don't look so sour," Ling laughed. "It would serve you right if I put you to work staining nerve tissue or shoveling the long snout pens. No, stop."
She grabbed Lark's arm. All signs of mockery vanished.
"I'm sorry. There really are things I want to discuss with you."
"Uthin is here." He pointed to the far end of the tent, where his fellow biologist, a large male Kewan with a slate-gray carapace, held conference with Ron, one of the two male forayers, a tall, massive man in a tight-fitting uniform.
"Uthin knows incredible detail about how different species relate to each other."
Ling agreed with a nod.
"That's not easy on a planet that has had infusions of outsider species every 20 million years or so, for eons. Your lore is impressive, given your limitations."
Had she any idea how far Gijoan lore really went? So far, the sages had not released his detailed charts, and Uthin must be dragging all 5 feet, cooperating just enough to stay indispensable. Yet the alien seemed easily impressed by sketchy glimmers of local acumen, which only showed how insultingly low their expectations were.
"Thanks," Lark muttered.
"Thanks a lot." Ling sighed, briefly averting her dark eyes.
"Crampers, can't I say anything right today? I don't mean to offend, it's just... Look, how about we try starting from scratch, all right?"
She held out a hand. Lark looked at it. What was he expected to do now? She reached out with her left hand to take his right wrists. Then her right hand clasped his.
"It's called a handshake. We use it to signify respect, amicable greeting, or agreement."
Lark blinked. Her grip was warm, firm, slightly moist.
"Oh, yes, I've heard of it."
He tried to respond when she squeezed, but it felt so strange and vaguely erotic that Lark let go sooner than she seemed to expect. His face felt warm.
"Is it a common gesture?"
"Very common, I hear, on Earth."
"You hear?"
Lark leaped on the passing phrase and knew it had begun again. Their game of hints and revelations, mutual scrutiny of clues and things left unsaid.
"I can see why we gave it up on Gijo," he commented.
"The Urs would hate it. Their hands are more personal than their genitals. Hoons and Kewans would crush our hands, and we'd squash the tendrils of any Gekaku tried it."
His fingers still felt tingly. He resisted an urge to look them over.
Definitely time to change the subject.
"So," Lark said, trying for a businesslike tone of equality, "you've never been to Earth?"
One eyebrow raised. Then she laughed.
"Oh, I knew we couldn't hire you for just a handful of biodegradable toys. Don't worry, Lark. You'll be paid in answers, some answers, at the end of each day, after you've earned them."
Lark sighed, although, in fact, the arrangement did not sound unsatisfactory.
"Very well, then. Why don't you tell me what it is you want to know?"
Asks.
"Each day we strive to mediate stress among our factions, from those urging cooperation with our uninvited guests to others seeking means to destroy them. Even our own sub-selves war over these options, making peace with felons, or fighting the unfightable. Damnation,
or extinction. And still our guests question us about other visitors. Have we seen other outsiders lately dropping from the sky? Are there buoyer sites we have not told them about? Sites where ancient mechanisms lurk, alert, still prone to vigorous action? Why this persistence? Surely they can tell we are not lying, that we know nothing more than we have told. Or is that true, my rings? Have all six shared equally with the commons, or are some withholding vital information needed by all? That I should think such a thing is but another measure of how far we are fallen, we unworthy, despicable sooners, we who surely have farther yet to fall.
Ready. Under a smaller, shabbier tent in a dense grove some secret distance from the research station, Reddy threw herself onto a reed mat, pounding it with both fists.
Stinkers! Rotten guts and rancy meat! Rotten, rotten, rotten!
She had good reason to thrash in outrage and self-pity. That liar, Dwyer, had told her the sages were good and wise, but they turned out to be horrid. Oh, not at the beginning. At first, her hopes had shot up like the geysers back home in the steaming gray hills. Lester Campbell and the others seemed so kind, easing her dread over being punished for her grandparents' crime of sneaking east over the Forbidden Mountains. Even before questioning her, they had doctors tend her scrapes and burns. It never occurred to Reddy to fear the unfamiliar Gekek and Treiki medics who dissolved away drops of clinging malt fluid, then used foam to drive off the parasites that had infested her scalp for as long as she could remember. She even found it in her to forgive them when they dashed her hopes of a cure for the scars on her face. Apparently there was a limit even to what Slopies could accomplish. From the moment she and Lark strode into the glade of gathering, everyone seemed awfully excited and distracted. At first Reddy thought it was because of her, but it soon grew clear that the real cause was visitors from the sky. No matter, it still felt like coming home, like being welcomed into the embrace of a family far bigger and sweeter than the dirty little band she had known for 14 awful years. At least it felt that way for a while. Till the betrayal. Till the sages called her once again to their pavilion and told her their decision. "It's all Dwyer's fault," she muttered later, nursing hot resentment. "Him and his rotten brother. If only I could have snuck in over the mountains without being seen, no one would have noticed me in all this ruckus." Reddy had no clear notion what she would have done after that. The oldsters back home had been murky in their handed-down tales about the slope. Perhaps she could make herself useful to some remote village as a trapper. Not for food. Slopies had plenty of that. But for soft furs that'd keep town folk from asking too closely where she came from. Back in the gray hills, such dreams used to help her pass each grinding day. Still, she might never have found the guts to flee her muddy clan but for the beautiful, bright bird. And now the sages had taken it away from her.
"We are grateful for your part in bringing this enigmatic wonder to us," Lester Campbell said less than an hour ago, with the winged thing spread on a table before him. "Meanwhile, though, something terribly urgent has come up. I hope you'll understand, Reddy, why it's become so necessary for you to go back."
Back? At first she could not bring herself to understand. She puzzled while he gabbled on and on. Back? Back to Jess and Bomb and their strutting ways, to the endless bullying of those big, strong hunters, always boasting around the campfire about petty, vicious triumphs that grew more exaggerated with each telling, to those wicked oafs who used fire-tipped sticks to punish anyone who dared talk back to them? Back? To where mothers watched half their babies waste away and die, to where that hardly mattered because new babies kept on coming, coming, and coming, till you dried up and died of old age before you were 40, back to all that hunger and dirt? The human sage had muttered the words and phrases that were supposed to sound soothing and noble and logical. But Reddy had stopped listening. They meant to send her back to the tribe. Oh, it might be fine to see Jass's face when she strode into camp, clothed and equipped with all the wonders the six could offer. But then, where would she be, condemned once more to that awful life? I won't go back, I won't. With that resolution, Reddy rolled over, wiped her eyes, and considered what to do. She could try running away, taking shelter elsewhere. Rumors told that all was not in perfect harmony among the six. So far, she had obeyed Campbell's request not to blab the story of her origins. But Reddy wondered, might some Urish or Kewan faction pay for the information? Or invite her to live among them? It's said the Urs sometimes let a chosen human ride upon their backs when the human's light enough and worthy. Reddy tried to picture life among the galloping clans, roaming bold and free across the open plains with wind blowing through her hair. Or what about going to sea with Hoons? There were islands nobody had ever set foot on, and flying fish and floating mountains made of ice. What an adventure that would be! Then there were the Treyiki of the swamps. A new thought abruptly occurred to her. Another option that suddenly appeared to lie open, one so amazing to contemplate that she just lay there silently for several duras, hands unclenching at last from their tightly clutched fists. Finally she sat up, pondering with growing excitement a possibility beyond any other ambition she had ever conceived. The more she thought about it, the better it began to seem. Part 11. The Book of the Sea. Animals think nothing of race, clan, or philosophy, nor of beauty, ethics, or investment in things that will long outlast their lives. All that matters to beasts is the moment. All that counts is self. Mates, offspring, siblings, and hive consorts, all these offer continuity of self. To even a loving beast, altruism has deep roots founded in self-interest. Sapient beings are not beasts. Loyalty binds even the innately egotistic to things nobler, more abstract than mere continuity or self. To race, clan, or philosophy, to beauty, ethics, or investment in fruits you and I will never harvest. If you seek the downward trail, the long road to redemption, if you want a second chance, shriven of your grief and worry, seek that path by returning to the soil, in forgetfulness of race, clan, or philosophy. Yet beware, lest the road take you too far. Keep faith in something greater than you are. Beware resumed obsession with the self. To those who have tasted vacuum and stardust, that way lies damnation. The Scroll of Redemption. Alvin's tale. The others are asleep now. It's late, but I want to get all this down because things are about to get busy, and I don't know when I'll have another chance. Tomorrow, we head back down the mountain, loaded with all kinds of gear lent to us by Uriel the Smith. So much stuff that we're feeling pretty dumb right now about our former plans. To think we were willing to trust our lives to some of the junk we designed. Uriel already sent messages to our parents, calligraphed on heavy cloth paper and sealed with her signet as a sage of the commons. So there's not much Huck's folks or mine can do to stop us. Not that I looked forward to facing them, anyway. What would I say? Hey, Pop, it'll be just like 20,000 leagues under the sea. Remember how often you read it to me when I was little? I recall now how the tale ended for Captain Nemo's submarine crew, and I can see why Yagweo regrets what a hummocker I've become. If my father confronts me over this, I'll discuss it in a language other than Anglic, to show that I really have thought it out several ways. This trip is more than a passing kid obsession, but something meaningful for our village and our race. Me and the others are going to make history. It's important for Ahun to be involved, from notion to motion to recollection. And once she decided, Uriel really got things rolling. Pincer Tip headed out the very same evening after Ziz was vlend, taking the newly budded Treyiki to his home hive for water adapting in the tide pool south of Wufon. Pincer will also use the Smith's authority to hire some red-shelled cousins to haul the Bathy's wooden hull to a meeting point down near the rift. The rest of us will come overland with supply wagons. Test dives start in just 5 days. The choice of a site was vital. There's just one place where the Midden's deep, watery trench plunges like a scythe blade toward the coast, where it sends a deep rupture of jagged canyons passing right next to Terminus Rock. By deploying a boom from an overhanging ledge, we won't even need to hire a ship. It's a relief to have a decision made at last. Even Huck admits the die is cast, accepting destiny with a shrugged rubbing of two eye stalks.
At least we'll be right there at the border, where I want to be anyway. When we finish, Uriel will owe us. She'll have to write us a warrant to go over the line and visit some Boyer ruins.
There's an Anglic word, tenacity, that comes out as stubbornness when I translate into Gal 6, which is one more reason why human speech best describes my pal Huck. All of us, even Uron, are more than a little surprised by how Uriel is throwing resources at our little adventure all of a sudden. We talked about the Smith's outbreak of helpfulness during our last evening on Mount Gwen, after a long day spent packing crates and going over inventory lists, waiting for the factory complex to settle down for the night.
"It must have had to do with the star shifts,"
Uron said, lifting her muzzle from the straw of her sleeping pallet. Huck turned two stalks toward Uron, leaving just one buried in her well-thumbed copy of Lord Valentine's Castle. She groaned.
"Not that again. What in the world could our dumbass little diving trip have to do with galactic cruisers coming to Gijo? Don't you think Uriel would have more important things on her mind?"
"What Gifiz said a week ago."
"Why not just admit you overheard Gibbs wrong? We asked again today, and that Treyiki doesn't recall seeing any spaceships."
"Not that Treyiki," I corrected. "We never had a chance to ask Gibbs anything before the Vlenning."
It's Tiug who said Ur doesn't remember.
Tiug, Gibbs, the difference can't be that great. Not even a Vlen Treiki would forget something like that.
Now, I wasn't so sure about that. Treiki memory wax can be tricky stuff, I hear. Then again, I'm hardly ever as sure as anything as Huck is of everything. Of course, there was one other person we could ask, but in the course of stowing gear and going over plans, I guess the fiery old smith dazzled us out of bringing the subject up. Intimidated may be a better word, though I'm not sure since I'm writing this by candlelight without my handy dictionary. All during the last few days, Uriel galloped from her normal duties to talks with her human guest, to tending her precious haul of discs, to flooding us with more details we never thought of during all our long months of planning an undersea adventure, a voyage none of us ever really expected to come true. In all the rushing about, there never seemed time to raise other questions, or else Uriel made it plain that some things weren't any of our business. At one point, I did try to ask about all the changes she had made in our plan. We always figured on starting by exploring the shallows near home, then redesign and refit before trying deeper water from a boat, maybe going down 10 or 20 cords. Now you're talking about doing 30 right from the start.
30 cords is not so very much,
Uriel dismissed with a snort.
Oh, I agree that your old air circulators wouldn't have been off to it. That's why I replaced the system with a superior one we had on hand. Also, your gasket would have leaked. As for the hull itself, your design will do.
I couldn't help wondering, where did all the equipment come from? We hadn't figured on needing a gas pressure regulator, for instance. Good thing Uriel pointed out the mistake and happened to have a beautiful handmade one in stock. But why did she already have one? Why would even the smith of Gwen Volcano need such a thing? Huck admitted it wasn't hurting our chances to have Uriel's competence behind us. Yet I worried. An air of mystery shrouded the Enterprise.
All will be made clear when you get to the rock, and everything is ready to go. I'll check the gear out myself, then I'll explain what you can do for me.
Barring day trips to Wufan, Uriel hardly ever left her forge. Now she wanted to take 2 weeks off. Adventuring with us? Never in my life has a single piece of news struck me the way that one did. At once, both reassuring and terrifying. Perhaps my nickname-sake felt the same way. When exploring the deep catacombs under Diaspar, he found something unimaginable. A mystery tunnel leading all the way to faraway Lys. So, there we were, Huck, Uron, and me, all packed up and ready to set off in the morn on an exploit that would either make us famous or kill us. Before that, though, there was one bit of business we had to take care of. We waited till night settled fully over Mount Gwen, when sunshine no longer filled the 100 clever skylights, leaving nothing to compete with the lava pools and glowing forges. The ore buckets and casting furnaces went silent, and laborers downed tools. Soon after evening meal, 7 gongs clanged, summoning Urish workers to perform their ritual grooming before settling down to sleep. Uron didn't like moving about at that hour, what Urs does, but she knew there was no other choice.
So we set forth single file from the warehouse chamber where Erdonnell had us barracked, picking our way without lanterns. Huck led, with two eye stalks stretched ahead as she spun quickly along a swooping stone ramp. The eyes facing backward seemed to glare at us each time she passed under a sky duct, catching glimmers of moonlight.
"Come on, you guys. You're so jeeky slow."
Euron muttered,
"Who had to carry her across rock fields for 3 days when we went exploring the Ytir caves? I still have folk scars in my flanks."
An exaggeration. I know how tough Urish hide is. Still, Huck does have a way of recalling only whatever seems convenient at the time. She had to stop and wait, huffing impatiently at intersections to let Euron show the way. Soon that meant exiting the warren of underground passages and following a trail of pounded pumice across a rocky plain that looked even more eerily alien, more starkly un-Jijoan by night than it did by day. In fact, we were crossing terrain much like pictures I've seen of Earth's moon. Speaking of moons, Great Lucen sat low in the west, the largest of Jijo's satellites, a familiar reddish crescent. Though right now, the main part facing us was dark, so no sunlight sparkled off the cold, dead cities the Buyer left there intact, as if to taunt us. Stars glittered overhead, like... Well, before writing this down, I racked my brain for a comparison out of some book I've read, but Earthling authors never had anything in their sky like the Dandelion Cluster, a giant puffball of sparkling pinpoints taking up almost a quarter of the sky, skimming the southern horizon. I know, 'cause if they did, they'd have competed to describe it over and over in a million different ways. Visitors from the crowded north part of the slope always act amazed to see it in its glory. So I guess the dandelion's one good thing about living here at the southmost boonies. It's also one chief reason why Uriel's predecessor built a telescope on that spot, and a dome to protect it against rain and ash from old Gwen's frequent mini-eruptions. Euron says there's just one part of the mountain where the observatory can take advantage of the sea breeze and not have heat currents ruin the seeing. There are probably much better places for astronomy on the slope, but this spot has one advantage. It's where Uriel lives. Who else has the time, wealth, and knowledge to maintain such a hobby? No one, except perhaps the savants of Great Byblos. The heavy cinder block structure seemed to rise against the dazzling starry cluster, reminding me of a glaiver's muzzle taking a bite out of a big gutchel pear. The sight made my back scales frickle. Of course, at this altitude, with no clouds in the sky, the air had a chilly bite. Whistling dismay, Euron halted in a sudden plume of dust, causing Huck to ram into me, eye stalks pronging outward, squinting in all directions at once. Little Hufu reacted by digging her claws into my shoulder, ready to leap and abandon us at the first sign of peril.
"What is it?"
I whispered urgently.
"The roof is open,"
Euron explained, slipping into Gal, too, as her pointed snout sniffed greedily.
"The mercury float-bearing I do scent. Therefore the telescope probably is in use. We must now undertake swiftly to return to our beds, not raising suspicion." "The hell you say?"
Huck cursed.
"I'm for sneaking in."
They looked to me for the deciding vote. I shrugged, human style. "We're here. Ought to at least take a look." Euron corkscrewed her neck. She snorted a sigh.
stay behind me in that case, and in vain hope of Ifni's luck, do remain quiet.
So we neared the dome, and made out that the roof line was split open, exposing blocky shapes to the shimmering sky. The path ended at a ground-level door, ajar, revealing dim shadows within. Hufu trembled on my shoulder, either from eagerness or from anxiety. I already regretted taking her along. Urant was an outline pressed against the outer wall, snaking her head through the door.
Of all utter jeeky things, what could top her scouting ahead at night?
Huck groused.
Urs can't see in the dark any better than the Glaver can at noon. Oughta let me do it.
Yeah, I thought, as if gekeks are built for stealth. But I kept silent, except for a low umble to prevent Hufu jumping off. Switching her braided tail nervously, Urran twisted her neck inside, and her long body followed, twisting nimbly through the doorway. Huck followed close behind, all eye stalks erect and quivering. Taking up the rear, I kept swiveling to check for anyone creeping behind, though, of course, there was no reason to imagine someone would want to. The main door of the observatory looked deserted. The big scope glittered faintly under starlight. On a nearby table, one hooded lantern spilled a red-filtered glow onto a clipboard sky chart and a pad covered with what might be mathematical markings. Lots of numbers plus some symbols that weren't part of any alphabet. Though now that I think about it, maybe Mr. Hines did show some of them to our class, hoping to hook an interest.
"Listen and note," Aaron said. "The motor for tracking objects in compensation against Jijo's rotation, that device is still turned on."
Sure enough, a low, hoon-like rumble transmitted from the telescope's case, and I smelled faint exhaust from a tiny fuel cell motor. Another extravagance almost unknown elsewhere on the slope, but allowed here because Mount Gwen is a sacred place, certain to cleanse itself of all toys, conceits, and unreverent vanities. If not tomorrow, then sometime in the next 100 years.
"That means it may still be pointed wherever they were looking before they left,"
Huck responded eagerly. "Who says they have left?" I was about to add. Turning around again, I noticed a closed door outlined by a pale rim of light. But Huck rushed on.
"Alvin, give me a boost so I can look."
"Hrum.
Alvin!"
A wheel stroked one of my footpads as a warning to do what I was told. "What? A boost?" I saw no ramp or other way for Huck to reach the scope's eyepiece, only a chair resting next to the table. Still, the best course would be to let her have her way as quickly and silently as possible, rather than forcing an argument. "Hrum. Well, all right, but keep it quiet, will you?" I stepped behind Huck, squatted down, and slung both arms under her axle frame. I grunted, lifting her to bring one stalk level with the eyepiece.
"Hold still," she hissed.
"I am. Hrum. Trying." I let my arm bone slip slightly so the elbow joints clicked into a locked position. A trick I'm told humans and Urs are jealous of, since even the strongest human who tried this would have to do it using muscle power alone.
Even so, Huck had put on weight, and holding her in place meant standing in a bent-over half-squat. Whenever I grunted, she'd twist a free stalk round a glare, just a hand's breadth from my face, as if I was annoying her on purpose.
"Hold it, you unbuffoon. Okay, I can see now. A whole lot of stars, more stars. Hey, there's nothing but stars in here."
"Huck," I murmured, "did I ask you to keep it quiet?" Euron whistled a sigh.
"Of course there's only stars, you hoof-stinky geek. Did you think you could count the fort holes for an orbiting starship with this little telescope? At that height, it'll twinkle like any other point source."
I was impressed. We all knew Euron as the best mechanic in our bunch, but who figured she knew astronomy as well?
"Here, give me a chance to look. It's possible I can tell which star isn't a star, if its position changes in relation to others."
Huck's wheels spun angrily in air, but she could no more deny the fairness of Euron's request and keep me from lowering her to the ground. I straightened with relief and some crackling of cartilage as she rolled away grumbling. Euron had to put both forehooves on the chair in order to rise up and peer through the eyepiece. For a few moments, our Irish pal was silent. Then she trilled frustration.
"They really are all just stars, far as I can tell. Anyway, I forgot. A starship in orbit would drift out of view in just a few duras, even with the tracking engine turned on."
"Well, I guess that's it," I said, only half disappointed. "We'd better head on back now." That's when I saw that Huck was gone. Whirling, I finally spied her, heading straight for the doorway I had seen earlier.
"Remember what we discussed,"
she called rearward at us, speeding toward the backlit rectangle.
"The real evidence will be on those photographic plates you say Gibbs spoke of. That's what we came up here to look at in the first place. Come on."
I admit, staring like a stranded fish, my throat sack blatting uselessly, while Hufu gouged my scalp, gathering purchase for a spring. Euron took off in a mad scramble after Huck, trying desperately to tackle her by the spokes before she reached the door, which swung open, I swear, at that very instant, casting a painful brightness that outlined a human silhouette. A short, narrow-shouldered male, whose fringe of head hair seemed to flame in the glare of several lanterns behind him. Blinking, raising a hand to shade my eyes, I could dimly make out several easels in the room beyond, bearing charts, measuring rules, and slick glass plates. More square plates lay racked on shelf after shelf, crowding the walls of the little room. Huck squealed to a stop so suddenly her axles glowed. Euron nearly rammed into her, halting in frantic haste. We all froze, caught in the act. The human's identity wasn't hard to guess, since only one of his race lived on the mountain at the time. He was only known far and wide as the most brilliant of his kind, a sage whose mind reached far, even for an earthling, to grasp many of the arcane secrets that our ancestors once knew, one whose intellect even the mighty, self-assured Uriel bowed before. The Smith of Mount Gwyn was not going to be pleased with us for intruding on her guest. Sage Purovsky stared for a long moment, blinking into the darkness beyond the doorway. Then he raised a hand straight toward us, pointing.
"You!"
he snapped in a strangely distracted tone of voice.
"You surprised me."
Huck was the first of us to recover.
Sorry, master, we were just...
Cutting her off, but without any trace of rancor, the human went on.
"It's just as well, then. I was about to ring for somebody. Would you kindly take these notes to Uriel for me?"
He held out a folded sheaf of papers, which Huck accepted in the grasp of one quivering tentacle arm. Her half-retracted eye stalks blinked in surprise.
"That's a good lad,"
the savant went on absent-mindedly, and turned to go back into the little room. Then Sage Purovsky stopped and swiveled to face us once more.
"Oh, please also tell Uriel that I'm now sure of it. Both ships are gone. I don't know what happened to the bigger one, the first one, since it appeared only by lucky accident on one early set of plates before anyone knew to look for it. That orbit can't be solved, except to say I think it may have landed. But even a rough calculation based on the last series shows the second ship deorbiting, heading into an entry spiral down at Jijo. Assuming no later deviations or corrections, its course would have made landfall some days ago, north of here, smack dab in the Rimmers."
His smile was rueful, ironic.
"In other words, the warning we sent up to the Glade may be somewhat superfluous."
Purovsky rubbed his eyes tiredly and sighed.
"By now, our colleagues at Gathering probably know a lot more about what's going on than we do."
I swear, he sounded more disappointed than worried over the arrival of something the exiles of Jijo had feared for 2,000 years. We all, even Hufu, stared for a long time, even after the man thanked us again, turned around, and closed the door behind him, leaving us alone with our only company, millions of stars, like pollen grains scattered on a shimmering ocean, stretching over our heads. A sea of darkness that suddenly felt frighteningly near.
Part 12. The Book of the Slope. Legends. There is a word we are asked not to say too often, and to whisper when we do. The Treiki ask this of us out of courtesy, respect, and superstition. The word is a name, with just 2 syllables, one they fear ever to hear again, a name they once called themselves, a name presumably still used by their cousins out on the star lanes of the 5 galaxies. Cousins who are mighty, terrifying, resolute, pitiless, and single-minded. How different that description seems to make our own sept of ringed ones from those who still roam the cosmos like gods. Those Jofer. Of all the races who came to Jijo in sneak ships, some, like Kewans and humans, were obscure and almost unknown in the 5 galaxies. Others, like Gekeks and Glavers, had reputations of modest extant among those needing their specialized skills. Hoon and Urs had made a moderate impression, so much that Earthlings knew of them before landing, and worried. But it is said that every oxygen-breathing, star-faring clan is familiar with the shape of stacked rings, piled high, ominous, and powerful. When the Treiki sneak ship came, the Gekek
took one look at the newcomers and went into hiding for several generations, cowering in fright, until at last they realized these were different rings. When Kewin settlers saw them already here, they very nearly left again, without unloading or even landing their sneak ship. How came our beloved friends to have such a reputation to live down? How came they to be so different from those who still fly in space, using that awful name? Reflections on the Six, Ovum Press, Year of Exile, 1915. Asks.
Either the invaders are trying to confuse us, or else there is something strange about them. At first their powers and knowledge appeared as one might expect, so far above us that we seem as brutish beasts. Dared we contrast our own meager wisdom, our simple ways against their magnificent, unstoppable machines, their healing arts, and especially the erudition of their piercing questions about Jijoan life? Erudition showing the vast sweep and depth of records at their command, surely copied from the final survey of this world 1,000,000 years ago. Yet they seem to know nothing about Lornix or Zookirs. They cannot hide their excitement upon measuring specimen glavers, as if they have made a great discovery. They make puzzling, nonsensical remarks concerning chimpanzees. And now they want to know everything about mulk spiders, asking naive questions that even this inexpert stack of many-colored rings could answer. Even if all our my toruses of sapiency were vlend away, leaving nothing but instinct, memory, and momentum. The sigil of the great library was missing from the bow of the great vessel that left their station here. We thought its absence a mere emblem of criminality, a negative symbol denoting a kind of skulking shame. Can it mean more than that? Much more?
Sarah. From Engril's shop on Pimmin Canal, it was but a short walk to the clinic where Pizora had taken the stranger yesterday. Engril agreed to meet Sarah there with Bloor the portraitist. Time was short. Perhaps Sarah's idea was foolish or impractical, but there would be no better moment to broach it, and no better person to present it to than Arianna Fu. A decision had to be made. So far the omens weren't good. The emissaries from Dolo Village had gathered last night in a tavern near the Urish Quarter to discuss what each of them had learned since the Haupfoa docked. Sarah showed a copy of the sage's report, fresh from Engril's copy shop, expecting it to shock the others. But by that evening even Pizora knew most of the story.
"I see three possibilities,"
the stern-browed farmer Jopp had said, nursing a mug of sour buttermilk.
"First, the story's an egg-cursed lie. The ship really is from the great institutes. We're about to be judged, as the scrolls say, but the sages are spreading a pebble-in-my-hoof fable about bandits to justify mustering the militia, preparing for a fight."
"That's absurd," Sarah had complained.
"Oh, yeah? Then why have all the units been called up? humans drilling in every village, Irish cavalry wheeling in all directions, and the Hoons oiling their old catapults, as if they could shoot down a starship by hurling rocks.
He shook his head.
What if the sages got some fantasy about resisting? It wouldn't be the first time leaders were driven mad by an approaching end to their days of petty power.
But what of these sketches?
Asked the scriven dancer, Fakun. The Gekek touched one of Engril's reproductions, portraying a pair of humans dressed in one-piece suits, staring brazenly at sights both new to them and yet somehow pathetic in their eyes. Jop shrugged.
Ridiculous on the face of it! What would humans be doing out here when our ancestors left Earth on an aged third-hand tub? Not a single human scientist understood its workings. The folks back home couldn't have caught up with galactic standard tech for another 10,000 years.
Sarah watched Blade and the Hoon captain react with surprise. It was no secret what Jop had said about human technology at the time of exile, but they must find it hard to picture. On Jijo, Earthlings were the engineers, the ones most often with answers.
"And who would want to perpetrate such a hoax?"
Ulgor asked, lowering her conical head. Sarah read tension in the Ur's body stance. "Uh-oh," she thought. Jop smiled.
"Why, maybe some bunch that sees opportunity amid the chaos to besmirch our honor and have one last chance at revenge before Judgment Day."
Human and Urs faced each other, each grinning a bright display of teeth, which could be taken equivocally as either friendly or threatening. For once, Sarah blessed the sickness that had caused nearly everyone's rauk to curl up and hibernate. There would have been no ambiguity with symbionts to translate the meeting in Jop's and Ulgor's hearts. At that moment, a squirt of pinkish steam jetted between the two, a swirling fume of cloying sweetness. Jop and Ulgor retreated from the cloud in opposite directions, covering their noses.
"Oops! I express repentance on our my behalf. This pile's digestive torus still retains, processes, deletes the richness of esteemed Hoonish shipboard fare."
Unperturbed, the captain of the Haupfoa said,
"How fortunate for you, Pizora. As to the subject at hand, we must still decide what advice to send back to Dolo Village and the settlements of the Upper Roni. So, let me ask Jop. What if we consider a simpler theory? There is no hoax by the honored sages.
Jop still waved the air in front of his face, coughing.
"That brings us to possibility number two, that we are being tested. The day has come at last, but the noble galactics are undecided what to do with us. Maybe the great institutes hired human actors to play this role, offering us a chance to tip the scales one way through right action or the other by choosing incorrectly. As for what advice we send upriver, I say we counsel that demolition should proceed according to the ancient plan."
Blade, the young Kewan delegate, reared back on three legs, lifting his blue carapace, stammering and hissing, so that his initial attempts at Anglic came out garbled. He switched to Galactic Two.
"Madness, you betray! This lunatic thing, how can you say? Our mighty dam, glorious to see and smell, must fall? For what reason, if our illicit existence on Jijo be already known?
Jop explained.
True, we can't hide our crime of colonization, but we can start the process of removing our works from this scarred world. By showing our good intentions, we'll prove we merit leniency. What we must not do, and I fear our sages may be fooled, is to offer any cooperation to these humans who pretend to be gene raiders. No bribes or service, since that too must be part of the test.
Ulgor snorted doubt.
And possibility three? What if they turn out to be felons after all?
Jop had shrugged.
Then the same answer holds. Passive resistance. Fade into the countryside. Tear down our cities.
Burn the libraries, Sarah cut in, and Jop glanced her way, then nodded curtly.
Above all else, they are the roots of conceit. Our outrageous pretense at remaining civilized.
He waved around him at the old Booyer chamber that had been converted to a tavern, the soot-stained walls adorned with spears, shields, and other souvenirs of the bloody siege of Tarryktown.
Civilized!
Jop laughed again.
We're like parrot ticks, reciting verses we do not understand, pathetically miming the ways of the mighty. If pirates have indeed come, such vanities can only lessen our skill at burrowing down. Our only chance of survival will be to blend in with Jijo's animals, to become the innocents that glaivers are in their blessed salvation. A salvation we might have achieved by now had humans not foiled nature with our so-called great printing. So, you see, it does not matter,
he concluded with a shrug of finality,
whether the visitors from space are noble chancellors from the Institute of Migration or the foulest criminals to prowl space. Either way, they are our judgment come at last. Our sole option remains the same.
Shaking her head in bemusement, Sarah had commented, You're starting to sound like Lark. But Jop saw nothing ironic in that. His radicalization had intensified each day since the deafening, terrifying specter shook the tree farms, leaving trails of noise and heat that seared the sky.
This is a bad thing,
Blade had said to Sarah later that evening, after Jop left to meet friends and fellow believers.
He seems sure of his reasoning and virtue, like a gray queen, unshakably convinced of her righteousness. Self-righteousness is a plague that afflicts all races except the Traiki,
answered Fakun, bowing two stalks toward Pizora.
Your folk are lucky to be spared the curse of egotism.
The Dolo village pharmacist had vented a soft sigh.
We urge you to make no simple assumptions, dear comrades. It is said that we, too, once possessed that talent, whose partner is the gift curse of ambition. To excise it from our natures meant leaving behind some of our greatest treasures, our finest rings. It must not have been an easy thing to do. One of the things I fear most about restored contact with galactics is something you other species and beings may not understand. We fear temptation by an enticing offer. We fear an offer to be made whole.
The clinic was a place of wheels, of Gekek surgeons and patients on pushchairs. Many of the Treiki pharmacists used scooter wagons, pushing along faster than most could walk alone. No wonder the smooth planarity of city life appealed to two of the six. The stranger's room was on the fifth floor, looking out across the confluence of the rivers Rhone and Bibor. Both steam ferries could be seen moored under screening arbors, now operating only at night, since vigilante groups had threatened to burn them if they budged by day. And this morning, confirming word came down from the glade. The high sages, too, wanted no unnecessary signs of technology revealed by the six. Destroy nothing, conceal everything. It only added to a growing sense of confusion among common folk. Was this Judgment Day or not? Sounds of raucous argument were heard in all parts of town. We need some goal to unite us, Sarah thought, or we'll start coming apart, skin and pelt, shell and spokes. A Treiki attendant motioned Sarah through to the private chamber that had been given the stranger. The dark man looked up when she entered and smiled with clear delight to see her. He laid aside a pencil and pad of pale paper, on which Sarah glimpsed the scene outside the window, one of the steam ferries, outlined with subtle countershading. Pinned to the wall was another sketch, depicting the shipboard concert on the fantail of the Hawupwoa, capturing a gentle interlude amid the storm of crisis.
"Thank you for coming,"
said an elderly, sallow-faced woman, seated by the stranger's bedside, looking surprisingly like a Gekek in coloration, her startling blue eyes, and also the way a wheelchair framed her blanket-shrouded form.
"We have been making progress, but there are some things I wanted to try only after you arrived."
Sarah still wondered why Arianna Fu, of all people, had taken an interest in the wounded man. With Lester Campbell and most other sages away, she was the highest-ranking human savant left this side of Byblos. One might expect her to have more urgent things on her mind right now than focusing her keen intellect on the problem of the stranger's origins. The Gekek doctor rolled forward, his voice mellow with a cultured accent.
"First, Sarah, please tell us, have you recalled anything further about our patient's aspect the day you pulled him from the swamp, all burned and torn?"
She shook her head silently.
"His clothing, none was recovered?"
"There were a few scraps, mostly charred. We threw them out while treating his burns."
"Did those scraps go to dross barrels?"
he asked eagerly.
"Those very barrels aboard the Hawupwoa right now?"
"There were no ornaments or buttons, if that's what you're looking for. The scraps went to recycling, which, in the case of old cloth, means going straight to my father's pulping machine. Would they have helped?"
"Perhaps,"
answered the old woman, clearly disappointed.
"We try to consider all possibilities."
The stranger's hands lay folded on his lap, and his eyes darted back and forth, focusing on faces as if he were fascinated not by words, but the sounds themselves.
"Can,"
she swallowed,
"can you do anything for him?" "That depends,"
the doctor replied.
"All burns and contusions are healing well, but our finest unguents are useless against structural damage.
Our enigmatic guest has lost part of his left temporal lobe, as though it had been torn out by some horrid predator. I am sure you know this area is where you humans process speech. Is there any chance of recovering what he has lost?
A Gekek shrug, twining two eye stalks, had never become fashionable among the other races.
If he were very young or female, there might be some transfer of speech facility to the right lobe. A few stroke victims do this, but the feat is rare for adult males whose brains